Hey, you're listening to Clinical Mistrials, a true crime podcast about unethical research in our communities and what's been done about it. I'm your host, Nicole Fisher. All right, let's get into it. It was the 1950s, and this was an interesting time in the U.S. We are coming off the heels of World War II, and a lot of folks are still reeling from the effects of the Great Depression. So a lot of families, it kind of put off having kids. So by the time we got to the 1950s and people kind of got back to business, we were hit with a pregnancy surge, which resulted in the baby boom. And I don't know, I feel like we kind of have a sense of that time, right? Like, I don't know, it's like Happy Days or any other Nick at Night special. Unwed pregnancy was incredibly shameful. It was a big no-no. And birth control options were super limited. In some states, birth control was completely illegal. And many women, regardless of their like marital status, they were pretty desperate for options to prevent pregnancy. And when I say desperate, I mean like they were hella desperate because, you know that phrase, back alley abortion? That was coined during this time. Also, many women were married like during college or quite soon thereafter. So what are you, like 22 or 23? So that means like without having a contraceptive that you can really count on, something that's like guaranteed, you're looking at the next three decades of baby making. That's a lot. Well, diaphragms were a thing, right? They were prescribable, but it was illegal to educate on how to use them. And there was all this, there was a ton of like red and legal tape around the distribution of diaphragms. So another option for women who were married and potentially had kids already were hysterectomies. But that is not an ideal solution. Also, who wants to do that? Nobody wants to do that. So another option was needed and necessary. And a woman and a nurse by the name of Margaret Sanger, she was determined to find that solution. And I'm going to give quite a bit of background about Sanger and her team. But before I do that, I really want to be like forthcoming and transparent in this. You know, while Sanger's contributions were instrumental to the expansion of reproductive health options, she was in fact a eugenicist. And eugenicists, they believed that the undesirable population should be weeded out for a more perfect and harmonious humanity. And that this could be accomplished through controlling the breeding of the undesirables. And undesirable, that was a term that kind of meant like people who were extremely poor, and for folks that society had deemed mentally unfit and physically unfit. And what I find super interesting about this stance for Sanger specifically was that she was born into poverty. Her mother was poor, she was born with 10 siblings, and she really like worked hard to kind of get into the position that we know her to be in today. And also she had just come out of World War II. And this was the same line of thinking that landed them in that situation to begin with. So anyway, that's Margaret. But now that I've gotten that out of the way, let's talk about her contributions to the advent of the birth control pill. So like I mentioned before, Margaret, she was a nurse, she was a reproductive rights activist, and she was like super determined to find better birth control options for women. And really though, she was really determined to find birth control options for women that were controllable by women. So she did a lot. She opened the first birth control clinics in the U.S., and she also established the American Birth Control League, which evolved into what we now know as Planned Parenthood. And she did a lot of writing. She wrote family planning. She wrote contraceptive literature. And all of this challenged a set of laws. It challenged a set of laws called the Comstock Laws. And these laws were actually nicknamed the Chastity Laws. These laws, they criminalized the sale of contraceptives, and they also prohibited the education of birth control. So, you know, Sanger, she was breaking rules left and right. And overall, she was pretty successful in what she did. I'll give it to her. You know, she made current contraceptives on the market accessible and more accessible to the public. She educated people on what their options were. And, you know, while she was doing all that, she realized that it wasn't cutting it. It wasn't enough. So she decided to kind of look for something better, something that gave her more of a medical guarantee. Now, let me introduce you to Dr. Pincus, Dr. Gregory Pincus. Pincus, he was a scientist. And at the time when they met, his most recent scientific breakthrough was a successful rabbit in vitro fertilization that didn't really go over well in general. The scientific community didn't gel with this. Harvard didn't like it. That's where he was working at the time. They were pretty concerned about what this meant for the human control over the reproductive process. And when I was reading this, the first thing that came to my mind, it just reminded me of like the bioethical concerns of the CRISPR gene editing back in the day. You guys remember that came out? It was like, I don't know, like definitely post 2010, because I was working in epidemiology at the time, but that blew up in a really weird way. So that's what I think was going on. And because of that, Harvard was like, all right, dude, you gotta go. They denied him tenure because his research was just too controversial. So he ended up establishing his own independent lab to continue his work on hormonal research. Ooh, I also forgot to mention that his peers gave him the nickname Dr. Frankenstein, which that's tough. Anyway, he was able, for his independent lab that he co-founded, he was able to secure financial backing from a company called GD Searle Pharmaceuticals, which was at the time based out of Illinois, but it's now a part of Pfizer. It's like a subsidiary of Pfizer. And they funneled him money for about a decade until they cut him off in 1951 because he hadn't really produced much of anything. But as luck would have it, that same year, he meets Margaret Sanger. Margaret pitched her idea of a medical or chemical contraceptive to him. And I think she was offering like a few thousand bucks to get it started. But our boy Pincus, he's been in this game for some time. And he knows what it takes. He knew it would take millions of dollars to get something actually accomplished. So he told her, if you can find me the funding, I will get you a product. So Sanger set out to find it. A couple years later, in 1953, Margaret introduced Pincus to Catherine Dexter McCormick. Sanger and McCormick, they were both a part of the suffragette movement and the female liberation movement. So they go way back. Now, I'll say most of everybody on this team is pretty problematic, including Catherine, but I'll say that Catherine is about her business. She doesn't play games. She has done some crazy things in the name of female liberation. She smuggled 1,000 diaphragms from Europe to New York. She was also really, really smart. She was one of the first women to graduate from MIT, and she got her degree in biology. Most importantly, though, to Sanger and to Pincus, she was famously wealthy, and she was deeply invested in finding a hormonal birth control. Sidebar, her fortune actually came from her husband, Stanley McCormick. And Stanley was the heir to the Harvester fortune. So yes, fellow Chicagoans, I mean those McCormicks, like the McCormicks and McCormick Place, McCormicks. So just wanted to throw that in there. Anyway, Catherine, she's smart. She has means. So she really digs into like Pincus's methodology and his plan. She wants to know how he's going to handle any social backlash. It's kind of unavoidable whether or not the study is successful or not. I guess he said everything she wanted to hear, because at the end of that meeting, she wrote him a check for $40,000, and that was just the first in many installments. Pincus, he snatched that up pretty quick, and he got to work in the lab. He was testing progesterone on rabbits with the hypothesis and the belief that this would stop ovulation. He was using injectables for the preclinical trials, so those are trials that are conducted on animals. But he knew that this method would be too painful for humans. And Pincus came to learn that his previous backer, G.D. Searle, remember them? They had already manufactured progesterone in pill form. Somehow he convinced them, like he convinces everybody of everything, to provide him with samples to use in human clinical trials. Now the thing is, Pincus, he was not a physician. He was a scientist, which is great for preclinical trials in animals. But for human subjects, you're gonna need a physician. You're gonna need an MD. Enter Dr. John Rock. John Rock was a renowned reproductive medicine specialist, and he was also a devout Catholic. And I mention this because Catholicism was in such stark conflict to any form of birth control that was outside of the rhythm method. Yet, somehow Rock was a supporter of other forms of birth control. But Sanger, she had run up against the Catholic Church before. They had some really specific and targeted anti-birth control campaigns that were set against her. She did not like them. And as such, Sanger was not feeling Rock, but somehow the rest of the team eventually kind of convinced her of his dedication to their cause. So he became a part of the team. In 1954, Rock initiated the first clinical trials for the progesterone pill with 60 women out of a Boston clinic called the Free Hospital. Again, just as a reminder, discussing options for birth control, that was criminalized. It was criminalized in Boston. It was criminalized in Massachusetts. So Rock disguised this study as a fertility clinical trial in order to kind of like get away with conducting it. The results after a few months found that nobody ovulated while on the pill, which was a success. That's what they wanted, right? But women were dropping out left and right due to the side effects. It was just too much for people to deal with. And one of those side effects was a reported psychosis. So Pincus, he became so frustrated and just like annoyed with the fact that people were dropping out. So he decided to test this side effect for himself. He started some clinical trials under the primary objective of possible tranquilizing effects, because you have to like have a reason for doing this, right? So he wrote it up as that. He recruited 16 females who were mentally ill patients from a Massachusetts asylum. He also tested this on 20 schizophrenic male patients, I might add, because, you know, what better population to test tranquilizing effects on other than people who are already suffering from mental illness or some form of psychosis? Cute. His results were eventually published in The Lancet. Also, like, he published his results? Like, no shame. Anyway, okay, his results were published in The Lancet, and he was criticized by the scientific community once again, and for good reason. One physician wrote this to the editors of The Lancet, and I'll just read this verbatim. "This use as guinea pigs of chronic psychotic patients who are not able to give or withhold valid permission in psychological research of this type must be as repugnant to many of your readers as it is to me." Honestly, the entire team overlooked the moral code of conduct for clinical trials, in my opinion. in their haste for a birth control pill. And, you know, I get the impression that no one was more eager than Moneybags McCormick. She had been chomping at the bit the entire time. Like, she even moved to Boston during Rock's clinical trials, despite her hatred for the winter and for cold weather. So when she learned that in order to get this pill actually on market, it would have to undergo clinical trials with a larger population in order to be approved by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, she became overwhelmed with impatience. She actually wrote this. She wrote Pincus asking, "Where can we find a cage of ovulating females?" Unfortunately, one of those cages was the island of Puerto Rico. Okay, in the same sort of way that I kind of like set the scene for the US mainland, I wanted to provide a bit of background for Puerto Rico as well, like so that we understand foundationally and fundamentally some of the events that led up to the birth control trials. So I'll try to do that here. So sterilization was an option for birth control in the US mainland for sure. We know that. But the climate for this, the climate for sterilization in Puerto Rico was on another level. Let's take a step back a bit. We'll go to 1937. Poverty was at an all-time high and unemployment had reached 37%. And this was due to a number of reasons, but it was in large part due to the influx of American companies coming in and buying up land that was already being farmed by locals. So this rendered a lot of people landless and jobless. All the while, the population was rising and tensions were rising. All of this friction kind of resulted in, initially peaceful protest, which devolved into what was called the Ponce Massacres. And this was the largest massacre that Puerto Rico has ever seen. That same year, 1937, the North American governor of Puerto Rico, Blanton Winship, he instituted a law. It was law number 136. And this law legalized sterilization based on the principles of eugenics. You got it. Some women that were interviewed in a documentary called La Operación about the sterilization practices in Puerto Rico, they said that they were hardly given any options to birth control other than sterilization. These operations were usually offered for free at clinics or heavily encouraged through political propaganda. And I've watched some of this, you know, I've watched a lot of this online, and it was heavily encouraged. This was really the only option for women who were poor and who needed to work in order to support their families during the war while their husbands were away. It was reported that Puerto Rico was facing a massive overpopulation issue at the time. So on April 30th in 1945, it was suggested by, and you know, I'm going to throw out a lot of names and dates here, so just kind of try to hang with me. I'm sorry about that, but I think it's really important. So it was suggested by the U.S. Tariff Commission that 1 million Puerto Ricans migrate to the U.S. So they did just that, you know, and a majority of them landed in New York City, which shouldn't be surprising for anyone who lives in this country. By 1953, almost a fifth, so 20% of ever married or, you know, people who are of childbearing age, Puerto Rican women, they had been sterilized. And that, of course, is an average of everybody. So this number really varied from like place to place. So actually at a factory right outside of San Juan, the sterilization rate was about 42%. So almost double the island average. But it was acknowledged that other tactics would be necessary in order to reduce the birth rate, yet keep up with the workforce that kind of like resulted from the post-World War II industry boom. And I know that those two things kind of sound like they conflict. It's like, how do we reduce the number of people that are being born, but we also have a ton of positions that are opening that we need to fill? What they mean by that is how they want to keep women from becoming pregnant so that they can work consistently without any gaps in employment. All right, back to the clinical trials. Puerto Rico had a large network of birth control centers. And actually, these clinics had once been funded by the U.S. government under something called the New Deal Law. I think it was under the Roosevelt administration. Some of these were even funded by other pharmaceutical heirs, I'd say. The heir to Procter & Gamble, Clarence Gamble, who was also a... Right, eugenicist. That's our word. It is our word for the day. There was a lot of interest in this island for conducting trials and for sterilizing the undesirable populations. In April of 1956, the birth control pill was introduced to Puerto Rico for clinical trials, and it was introduced via a housing project in Rio Piedras. In a neighborhood, El Fanguito, which had been described as the poorest of the poor. And this literally translates to mud hole. These were the slums, y'all. And women hadn't had the opportunity or the access to education, and they were relatively immobile. And they really relied and trusted in their doctors and their nurses to help them make the best healthcare decisions for themselves and for their families. Nurses were sent to each apartment to recruit women into the family planning program for a new treatment. You guys can see, but I just put air quotes around that because we'll get into that later. But the pills were offered for free, and they were really encouraged for folks who couldn't afford to have more children. And these women, they had no clue that they were being recruited into clinical trials. Okay, so let's get into what I was saying earlier. All of us who have worked in clinical research understand how important language is and how important language is here. Calling something that's experimental a treatment or a medicine, that's super suspect. That makes it seem like it's, you know, something that has already been tested and is tried and true. Also, I just wanted to say that, like, being educated in this situation didn't really account for much, because there were 20 female medical students that they recruited from the University of Puerto Rico into this clinical trial. And get this, once these women started, you know, kind of suffering from the side effects that the Boston women suffered from, and they tried to withdraw their participation, withdraw their informed consent, but there was none, so okay. Withdraw their participation, they were threatened with bad grades. So if they were to withdraw from the clinical trial, they would be failed. So education didn't really save anyone. A physician who was working in Puerto Rico during this time said that it became pretty clear to her and to other medical staff that this was experimental. She said, I'll quote her here. She said, Puerto Rico was being used as a laboratory for the development of birth control technology. And, you know, I actually found a quote from Pincus where he referred to Puerto Rico as the perfect laboratory. So she's right. Mrs. Delia Mestre of Humacao was interviewed by the Orlando Sentinel in 2004. And during that interview, they talked about a lot, and she ended up welling up with tears. She asked this, why didn't anyone let us make some decisions for ourselves? And she went on to say, I have difficulty explaining that time to my own grown children. I have very mixed feelings about the entire thing. These women were provided with a 10 milligram progesterone pill, that included a small dose of estrogen. And that's like 10 times of what's given today in the pill. Subjects were made to take one tablet a day for the majority of their menstrual cycle. There was no safety information given because really, what safety information did they have or believe in? One woman by the name of Maria, she said that she took it on an empty stomach and her head started spinning. She almost passed out. And she said that she had no idea that they were some of the first people to try this. Some of the reported effects were nausea, headaches, dizziness, stomach pain, vomiting, and those were just like reported. And then later, obviously, like issues potentially related to stroke and blood clots. Anyway, after a 9-month data review, the Puerto Rican medical director reported that the pill was 100% effective, but due to the many side effects, it probably wouldn't perform well on the U.S. market. Rock and Pincus, they disagreed with her assessment, and they thought that the side effects were completely acceptable, or if they weren't acceptable and they were real, or potentially the patients and subjects thought that it was real, they were psychosomatic. Later in a New York Times article, Pincus would be quoted as saying, "These side effects are largely psychogenic. Most of them happen because women expect them." 3 women died, but no one even bothered to perform an autopsy to determine the cause of death or a potential association to the pill. Now, in a few articles and videos that I watched on this case, there's a lot of commentary about like informed consent wasn't as important as it is today, and it was unregulated time, but you know, that is like a lot of excusing away of reckless behavior. And from what people have written, even at that time, about some of these like clinical trials, I don't think that's true. And I also don't care. This was a calculated move. This was a calculated move to conduct a clinical trial a previously failed clinical trial in a country that had no restriction on birth control, in a country that had laws that supported sterilization, and on a country with a population that had like little to no agency. So this was not a mistake. And again, I do not care. All right, so G.D. Searle. G.D. Searle, they were tempted by the perceived success of the birth control pill, but they were still pretty concerned about the Catholic Church. They were worried that they would boycott the pill, or worse, they would boycott all of their products. And honestly, this was not an unreasonable risk, considering how about a quarter of Americans were Catholic. And I'm going to give a bit of credit to Searle here, because the medical director wrote to Rock with the concern saying, "We here have long been disturbed by the casualness with which materials pass from Pincus's animals to your patients." So instead of marketing this as a birth control method, Searle released the pill in 1957, about a year after the initial Puerto Rico trials. They released it as a treatment for menstrual disorders, and they called it Inovit. But, it was pretty much understood widely that the pill was useful in preventing pregnancy. So that's really what women were lining up for. Searle quickly got over the fear of boycott after they realized the success of Inovit, and considering that this product was one that would be, as we know, chronically purchased and taken by women every single day for, again, almost 3 decades of their lives. They all of a sudden were on board, and they wanted to throw caution to the wind and expedite the approval process to the FDA. On May 11th, 1960, the FDA approved the pill as a form of contraceptive after reviewing a cohort of 130 women, including 30 control subjects that were not taking the pill. And honestly, this really isn't enough people, but I read in a couple of articles that the way that they displayed the data was a little bit manipulating, but this is supposed to be a short podcast episode, so I'll leave that there. At the end of the trials in Puerto Rico, approximately 1,500 women were unknowing participants of these trials. By 1965, over 6 million women were taking the pill. And it felt like a massive success for women's rights and like sexual liberation and reproductive freedoms on the mainland. And there was this mindset shift. Now people expected that you would and you could plan for your reproduction. So women were hired into positions that they were originally potentially overlooked for out of fear of them having to like fall off of a project or fall off of a case with an unexpected pregnancy. And I say that like it's fair, but I hope that you know that like, or I'll just say that's super discriminatory. Not fair, but this is what happened. Anyway, in the late 1960s, there were a lot of side effects being reported by the American patients who were on the pill. Surprise, surprise, these were the same side effects that were reported during the Puerto Rican trials, also that were still ongoing at the same time. So meanwhile, in Puerto Rico, the mayor of the municipality Barceloneta lauded the female sterilization program as a success. And it was a success when the 1970 census showed that there was no increase to the local population. The program had restricted families to no more than 3 people, and he noted in an interview that it had been so successful because he noticed that many schools in various barrios had to close because there were no first grade children to attend them. And okay, I don't mean to get too much in the weeds here and like jump into policy, but this is really important stuff. And I like to like, you know, parallel what was going on socially with the construct, you know, politically, because they go hand in hand. All right. The United States Agency for International Development, AID, they increased their budget for birth control by $100 million in Latin America between 1968 and 1972. At the same time, they reduced the budget for other very necessary healthcare aid by the exact same amount. So, the U.S. government is funneling money into the sterilization program. And in 1974, a governmental report recommended yet another migration of Puerto Rican residents to the U.S. mainland and some other form of reduction to the island's birth rate. All right, I know that I've thrown a lot of names at you all already, but okay, I'm going to introduce Dr. Antonio Silva, and I have a lot more information on this guy if anyone's interested, but I won't get into it here. Anyway, he was the director of the Puerto Rican Family Planning Program at that time. And he was super proud of himself for revamping this program as a response, which resulted in the sterilization of 24,000 Puerto Rican women. And again, this is intentional. In 1977, AID, the organization I just mentioned, AID's population operation officer, Richard T. Ravenholt, he reported that the U.S. goal was to achieve sterilization for 1/4 of the world's women in order to prevent revolutions that interfere with the financial interests of multinational corporations. In 1974, someone finally called this mess out at a United Nations assembly meeting. Puerto Rican independence leaders accused the United States of carrying out a genocidal plan. And in the U.S., when the public got wind of this and women, you know, started having their own adverse events and their own side effects, and they also learned that women had died in early studies from a potential stroke or blood clot, they began to organize protests. So come 1970, experts, all white men, were gathered at the Senate to discuss the pill's side effects. And they didn't even allow any women to testify. So, you know, the more things change. One researcher at the Senate hearing stated that estrogen is to cancer what fertilizer is to wheat. there were female activists present at the hearings and in the audience. So upon hearing this, they stood up and they began to voice their concerns. They said that they weren't given any information when they were given the pill, or at least they weren't given enough information to make a real informed decision. You know those like little pamphlets that you get when you get like when you get anything really, but definitely when you get a medication. That wasn't a part of this. So one of the senators, Senator Nelson, who actually honestly he had been taking on a lot of pharma companies for some of their abusive practices. So I'll give him that. But God bless him, he made the mistake of telling these women to have a seat and be quiet. And I don't know. Like, picture that. Picture these women. These women in the 70s. These are our grandmothers. These are our great aunts. And I don't know. Like, would I want to be in a room where Althea Embry is being told to sit down and be quiet? And that's my great aunt. And she's not for play. Like, I would expect something like what transpired next in this Senate hearing. These women, they erupted. They approached the Senate bench, and I say approach because I'm being polite. They rushed that Senate bench, and they were asking questions like, you know, why are you using women as guinea pigs? Why are you letting the drug companies murder us for their profit and convenience? So yeah, like they quickly adjourned that meeting. And they have, this is recorded, this is taped. I encourage all of you to go take a look at this on YouTube. It is entertaining. And it's entertaining because we know what happens next and we know that these women, their voices were heard. And later on, as a result of these Senate hearings and as a result of these women protesting and using their voice, the hormone levels in birth control pills, they were significantly reduced, and safety information and risk information, it had to be included in every birth control packet. And, you know, at the time it was estimated that almost 80% of all American women were or had taken the pill, and over 10 million women were actively on the pill. However, Black women were very few among those numbers, and this is a bit of an aside, but I thought it was worth mentioning. There had already been concerns in the Black community around family planning that was conducted out of white establishments like Planned Parenthood, those being a vehicle for racial genocide, which, all right, we see what happened. So the involuntary sterilization that was so prevalent in places like in the South, it was so prevalent that they actually had a name for it. It was called the Mississippi appendectomy. They saw this pill as another form of control. But in the end, Black women understood their concerns and they like, you know, kind of reconciled with it. And they decided that they wanted the same opportunity to control their reproduction as their white counterparts. I also really wanted to mention that these birth control pill trials, they were not isolated to Puerto Rico. They also took place in Mexico and in Haiti. Dr. Iris Ophelia Lopez, she wrote about this in her book, Matters of Choice, Puerto Rican Women's Struggle for Reproductive Freedom. She's this dope social anthropologist, and this book is like an ethnography based on 25 years of her research into multi-generational life histories of Puerto Rican families that live in New York. I read some excerpts of this book, but the entire book, it's up next on my reading list. And, you know, I was kind of thinking that it might be fun to raffle off a couple of these books to y'all. And, you know, like a couple, because these are still used in colleges and universities because she's a professor. So they're a little pricey. So y'all gonna get like two. If you are not already, please follow me on Instagram, and I'm at Clinical Mistrials, that's the handle, and there I'll post some information about the raffle. But that's it, folks. Thanks so much for hanging in there with me in this. I know there were a lot of dates, there were a lot of people. I have a lot of resources and a lot of additional information that didn't even make this episode. it just was a lot. It has legs to it. So if you have any questions, if you have any comments, email me. You can email me at clinicalmistrials@gmail.com, or you can DM me on Insta, whatever you want. And you know, it means everything to me that you listen and that you follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, I'm your host, Nicole Fisher, and you've been listening to Clinical Mistrials.